services, no public force and order in large parts of Colombia, which is a beautiful country with enormous rainforests, mountains, pristine nature. Some 80 indigenous groups are really at the point of extermination. Their culture is gone, really, because they have been displaced by their land, by these armed groups and the drug lords. Often there is an overlap between them for land, for the coca trade. There is an increase in narcotics production, and the narcotics is the fuel for the violence, and the civilian population that is not protected are displaced. We are some humanitarian groups that are doing our very best to help. I went 4 hours with my colleagues in boat up the rivers to meet some of these indigenous groups and the Afro-Colombian communities, and they are completely suffering alone. We can give them some humanitarian aid, but we can't give them protection. And then we see that these people who have all their arms in the world are burning down the forest, displacing the people, and working with complete impunity.
I want to bring Manuel Rosenthal into this conversation, the Colombian physician and activist, to talk about the root causes of the violence, Manuel, and to talk about what the government is doing. There are negotiations around ceasefires with armed factions, including the FARC, and how significant is U.S. involvement in any of this?
Thank you. Good morning. And it's good to hear Jan Egeland's voice. We remember him well here from his previous stay in Colombia. Yes, one of the things I'd like to add to Mr. Egeland's comments now is, yes, for sure, what he says is absolutely true in terms of COCA and the different armed factions. But one has to remember that when the peace agreement was signed between FARC and the Colombian government, even prior to this agreement that was signed in 2016, enormous oil extracting concessions were made to transnational corporations within the entire Amazon region. So one has to add these factors to begin to explain what is going on. I'll give you an image of what Mr. Egeland is describing. Colombia is becoming a series, or could become, if it continues in this direction, it could become a series of autonomous criminal territories, huge territories, not only rural, but certainly rural with the data that we've been provided already, but urban and rural. Armed factions, it doesn't matter, they can portray themselves as right, left, involved in drug trade, etc. Huge armed factions are linked to local mafias that are also connected to government positions and to the state. And these connections, these assemblies, are taking over territories and controlling populations in a way such that, for example, if you see that there's a decrease in the number of assassinations, kidnappings, etc., it usually means that these armed factions have gained control over the territories and they have established a violent form of government and state. So there is an absence of a state that we could refer to as the ideal state that provides health, education, protection, etc. But there is a presence of a different kind of state being established in Colombia. And it is that way, and it can happen that way on the background of extreme social inequalities, extreme poverty that pushed people into two types of economies, illegal economies. One is surviving through what's available, and that's the coca marijuana production. Colombia produces 92% of global cocaine and nearly as much of the marijuana. And then the other type of economy is war itself. If you're recruited, you receive some kind of income or you make it. So this is our state. There's no absence of a state. This is the state in Colombia. And it's linked to, in many cases and in many territories, linked to the form of government and state that traditionally has been engaged in these kinds of activities. So I had this combination. Now, the U.S. involvement in this, I just make one simple, small comment. And that comment is General Laura Richardson, who is the Pentagon in charge of the U.S. South Command, has made it very clear that the interest in this region, the entire region, includes the Amazon and other territories for resources. So it is the old imperial discourse in terms of a competition against the Chinese and the Russians for the control of these territories, and the main and only interest is extractive. The rest is just discourse. So this is what we're living through. Amy, in fact, I was just remembering, as I was listening to Mr. Hegland, your book on Nigeria years ago. I'm in northern Cauca. Mr. Hegland knows that what's going on here is the same as in Nariño. And what we live through is what you described in Nigeria when you were stopped by armed people and you weren't killed by miracle because your life was in their hands. This is the power and the government and the state in Colombia. The rest is discourse and an image. It's no different from what's happening with barbecue in Haiti, although in a different degree, but with specificities.
Jan Eglem, could you first of all talk about what Manuel said, but also what officials in the Colombian government you met with, if any, and what they told you, what steps they're taking to address this massive humanitarian crisis?
Manuel is right, of course, and he describes well this complete lack of protection for civilians and the insecurity where
it seems that we've lost Jan Eglund at the moment. So, Manuel, if you could talk about the government of President Gustavo Petro and the policies that the government has had with respect to these multiple armed conflicts and the crisis that's been unfolding, his policy of total peace and what came of that.
The intentions of this government are excellent, and that's why he received this massive support. And his initial proposal as a candidate was total peace, and that's what he's acting on. Total peace means negotiating with any and all armed actors. Some are political actors or portray themselves to be political, and the armed insurgencies, and the other ones are criminal groups. So he offered a differential approach to each one of them. One would go and submit themselves to justice with favorable conditions in exchange for peace. The others would negotiate a political solution after the peace agreement was signed in Colombia, not kept by the government, and led to not one armed faction of FARC, but many armed factions. So in this context, Petro offers this process and begins to work on this. The problem with President Petro's proposal is twofold. One is a repetition of the mistake made, I think intentionally, by President Santos, who is a Nobel laureate, which was a negotiation that excluded the population. It was a negotiation between the armed factions on behalf of the people to distribute the country and the country's resources between them. And then, of course, that wasn't kept by the governments that came back. Now, Petro is doing the same. He's negotiating with the armed factions and the communities and populations who suffer these, as Mr. Eglin exposed, are being essentially ignored. So that's one mistake. The second mistake, and it's a huge mistake, is precisely in a discourse addressing the drug economy and the extractivist economy, but in practice, not developing real, concrete, viable, feasible alternatives to this. And he is within a government that is actually under the control of a state that has become an authoritarian mafia-type structure. So it couldn't work. But the intentions are good, the discourse is good, but people are feeling desperate on the ground.
Well, we have Jan Egeland back now in studio in Bogota. Jan Egeland, if you could continue what you were saying earlier and speak about your meetings with officials in Colombia.
It is true that the government is trying to do a lot to bring peace and bring development to all of these vulnerable groups. But the point is that since the agreement in 2016, which brought so much hope and the Nobel Prize to President Santos, as Manuel said, the FARC did demobilize, but then lots of other groups took their space, took the territory, took the drug trade, and there was no government to help bring an alternative development, alternative services to the people. So there was a vacuum, and that was filled by other armed men, and some of them are now back from the FARC. I will meet today, and the government needs then to do much more and work more effectively with the international community. I will meet the diplomats here in Bogota today, and I will say to them, listen, we have less funding today for development projects, for humanitarian relief, for support to Indian tribes at the point of extermination. There is less support for the alternative to war than there was before, and it's being ignored that people are giving up hope in Venezuela next door, in large parts of Colombia, in Ecuador, in Central America, and many other parts of the world. So of course people will be tracking north for hope and a better life in the north. If you don't give people hope where they are and security where they are, of course they will wander north to the US, to Canada, to Mexico. I would do so in the same situation if there was no hope for me and my family or a better life and some protection against violence.
Jan Egeland, before you go, I wanted to ask you about another country, about Sudan. As the U.S.-led peace talks have begun in Geneva, Switzerland, there are conflicting reports on the state of the talks today. According to the BBC, neither the Sudanese army nor the rapid support forces took part in this first day of talks. But there are reports that the RSF did send a negotiating team to Geneva, though it's unclear if they showed up at the talks. Last week, you wrote on social media, Sudan's man-made mass deaths must and can stop. If you can respond to what's happening in Geneva and if you hold out any hope.
We had high hopes for the Geneva talks because the situation in Sudan is so desperate. It's the first man-made famine on a watch for half a generation. In the Zamzam camp in northern Darfur, it's 500,000 people there, and they are dying in masses because of starvation and because of blunt violence. The talks is not really on at all because the two sides do not seem to care for the people that they say they represent, which means there has to be much more pressure on the two sides in the Sudanese conflict. It's a little bit like the Gaza situation that we also discussed. Neither Netanyahu nor Hamas have an interest in making peace. It's very clear. So the US, the West, the regional powers have to make much more pressure on the parties, just like the Gulf states, the neighbors to Sudan, and others have to make much more pressure on the two sides in Sudan so that they end this absolutely senseless war before the whole civilization in Sudan is torn to pieces.
Jan Egeland, we want to thank you for being with us, Secretary General of the Norwegian Refugee Council, speaking to us from Bogota, the capital of Colombia. We also want to thank Manuel Rosenthal, Colombian physician and activist, speaking to us from northern Cauca in Colombia. Coming up, we look at Burma, where up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in attacks as they attempted to flee to Bangladesh. We'll get the latest. Stay with us. La Guaneña by Omar Flores de Armas. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
We end today's show looking at Burma, where up to 200 Rohingya Muslims were recently killed in drone strikes as they attempted to flee to Bangladesh. This comes amid intensifying conflict between the military junta and the Arakan Army, a rebel-armed group. Survivors of the drone strikes accused the Arakan Army of carrying out the assault, while the rebel group blamed the military junta, which overthrew Burma's elected government in 2021. A new report from Human Rights Watch finds the military and rebel-armed groups have committed extrajudicial killings, unlawful recruitment for combat, and widespread arson against Rohingya Muslims and other civilians in the area.
During last week's drone attack, many Rohingya also died while trying to escape by sea. This is an account by one man who lost five children after they drowned while trying to flee the attack by boat.
Starting at 5 p.m. on August 5th, the Arakan Army fired weapons incessantly. The next morning, on August 6th, for survival, we decided to flee to Bangladesh. So I decided firstly to flee a family with a small boat. Then a big boat will be sent. My family got on a small boat. My sister's family also got on there. While fleeing, one boat sank. The people from that boat dragged down the boat we were on, and the boat we were on sank too. Only 6 to 7 survived out of almost 40. From my family, my five children, four children from my sister's family were lost, and other elderly youths and women were lost.
We're joined right now by Nathan Nguyen. He is co-founder of the Free Rohingya Coalition. He's joining us from Frankfurt, Germany. Welcome to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what happened, but also for a global audience, put this into a larger context? If you can hear Nathan Nguyen, can you hear us here in New York? Let's go to another clip as we try to make a connection with Nathan Nguyen. In the latest wave of violence against Burma's Rohingyas, thousands in Rakhine State in Burma were forced to flee as their homes were burnt down overnight. This was in May. This is Saifur Rahman, a 30-year-old Rohingya father who managed to flee to Bangladesh and escape the violence with his wife and their two young children.
The Arakan army set fire to our house. They were firing guns randomly and rapidly. I had a brother who got arrested and later was shot dead. I don't know where my parents are now, probably dead. My wife and I whisked our two children and ran to the main road to save our lives and never looked back. We went to different villages across the mountains, keeping a low profile, and eventually managed to come here to Bangladesh. Tens of thousands, all people from the surrounding villages, were escaping the attack. Nobody was looking back. We were running to save our lives.
So if we could turn now to Nay San Lin, who is joining us from Frankfurt, Germany. We just played two clips. If you can talk about the latest attack on the Rohingya and put it in a larger context of what's happening in Burma today.
Well, thank you so much for having me today. So as you have mentioned about the Naf River massacre, where the more than 200 Rohingya were massacred by the drone strike by the Arakan army, that happened on August 5th. As of now, the Mondo downtown, the urban area has been empty as of today morning. And the Arakan army soldiers are in the town. They are looting the Rohingya houses. And the Rohingya are, you know, what they call the evacuated, but it is actually forcibly relocated to somewhere else. They are now at the border where the Myanmar military junta has built the temporary camp. Most of the people are there, and some of the people are relocated to some other villages. So there are some fighting still ongoing, but and like before. Let me talk a little bit about this Mondo town. Since the early June, the Arakan army has been fighting against the military there. But whenever they launch the drone attack or the artillery attack, they target the Rohingya people. The military base is opposite direction of the Rohingya villages. But still, every day they target the Rohingya village. Every day there were two or three, sometimes five, six Rohingya were killed, many injured. So on August 3rd, since the, you know, their this drone strike increased, on August 5th, in the afternoon, the people decided to flee to Bangladesh. Then they gather at the bank of the Naf River. Around at 5 p.m., the Arakan army is dropped the drone bomb and resulted in more than 200 dead and the many injured. And also, at the same time, when a boat tried to flee from there, they dropped the drone bomb, and as a result, only two survived. There were more than 20 people on board. Next day morning, just now you have played the clip. He's the survivor of the from the boat, you know. So we think at least, including that this death from the boat, I think at least 250 were, you know, die, including this Naf River massacre. This is the scale of the killing is compared to the Budirang Township. It is the small scale. In Budirang Township, before the May 17, the Arakan army has committed the significant massacre in different villages. In one single village on May 2nd, they killed more than 600 people. I spoke to some survivor. Only a few people survived, and the eyewitness and the people who know about this massacre. I have also got the family list. So they have committed the same massacre in the different village as well. In Budirang alone, they have killed more than 2,000, and they have burned down the more than 8,500 Rohingya houses. So in Mondo, the same thing they are doing. They have the intention to cleanse the Rohingya people. That we can prove if we read the article that published in the Foreign Policy magazine 10 years ago, and also the 6 years ago, the elder brother of the Arakan army chief, you know, delivered his speech in the private meeting, which leaked to the, you know, the social media. In this speech, he said, you know, we have to strategize to cleanse the Rohingya from, they call the Bengali, these people from the Budirang and Mondo township. This is what exactly they are doing now. What they are doing is they are, you know, they're carrying out the unfinished business of the Myanmar military.
And if you could explain, Nay San Lin, the origins of this crisis, the historical context with the crisis, the Rohingya crisis beginning in August 2017.
Well, you know, the Rohingya genocide began in 1978, more than 45 years ago. So the massive violence against in 2017 is not the first one. The first one occurred in 1978, then again in 1991, 1992, and 2012, 2016. The latest wave was in 2017. So it is the very long decade persecution by the Myanmar military to cleanse the entire population from the country. As of now, only about the 600,000 remain in the country. So the Arakan army is trying to cleanse about 300,000 who are remained in the Budirao and the Maundaw Township. These are the Rohingya majority area. Normally, before the 2017, there were more than 1 million people there. But in 2017, Myanmar military cleansed about 750,000 and more than 10,000 were killed. Hundreds of women and girls were raped. So as of now, the humanitarian situation is very dire. There are no humanitarian agency present, and the people are depending on the money sent by their relative live in the diaspora. And also, there are a lot of commissions they need to pay. They cannot move from.
Nay Sungwin, what is the relationship between the Arakan army and the Burma military? And, you know, you're saying Myanmar, we are saying Burma. It's the same country. The military regime renamed it Myanmar.
True. So they don't have the relation. The Arakan army is fighting against the military since the late 2018 in Rakhine State. So they had the on and off the ceasefire. But since last year, November, they have been continuously fighting against the military. But they are the enemy each other. But when it comes to the Rohingya issue, they have the same intention. The Arakan army has also same intention as the Burmese military. Burma military. That is why they are now cleaning in the Rohingya. They have killed in 3 months of time, in four months of time, they have killed more than 2,500 Rohingya in two townships and displaced around 300,000 Rohingya now.
And what should the international community do at this point? And does the student uprising in Bangladesh that ultimately threw out the prime minister there, does it have an impact on Burma and what's happening there?
Well, you know that the Burmese people, especially the people who are working to bring back the democracy in Myanmar, and also the younger people engaging with in the Spring Revolution, they are very happy and they are congratulating the Bangladeshi student. They have seen the real change in Bangladesh. So they are also hoping. But the problem with the international community, well, when it comes to the Burma, the international community is letting the Burmese military to enjoy the impunity until now. You know, 2 years ago, 2.5 years ago, the U.S. government determined the crime against Rohingya as a genocide and the crime against humanity, but nothing followed. So all the, you know, this justice avenue, they have to take the serious action against the Myanmar military and end the impunity. So since the international community is failing again and again on the Rohingya, the Arakan army is also committing the same crime. You know, whatever they have committed against the Rohingya is amounted to crime against humanity and the war crime. So they think they will also enjoy the impunity. And that is why to end the impunity by the international community is really very much crucial. And also the Myanmar, the Burmese military is under the sanction by the Western government. The Arakan army also need the same sanction. So until now, you know, more than 2,500 people have been killed, but we didn't see any, you know, the few line statement from the U.S. state government and also the European government and the U.K. government and also the Canadian government.
We have to thank you so much for being with us. Co-founder of the Free Rohingya Coalition, speaking to us from Frankfurt, Germany. Tune in next week when Democracy Now! Will be broadcasting 2 hours daily from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago beginning Monday. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
If you're a Canadian Indigenous student considering many life choices about your future, Inspire can help. If you need ideas about possible education or career path options specifically for First Nations, Métis, and Inuit folks like you, join Inspire's mentorship program, Rivers to Success. It's free to register, and you'll get plenty of up-to-the-minute information about university, college, and vocational trade schools. Most importantly, again, it's free. It's free, it's free, it's free. It's online, and we have monthly events with prizes. Discover the many potential job and study opportunities that are waiting for you across Turtle Island. Register online now at rivers2success.ca. Again, that's rivers2success.ca.